Welcome to Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. On this week's episode of the podcast, we are joined by Giselle Medina, religion, culture, and immigration reporter at Fresnoland, Melissa Montalvo, the accountability reporter at the Fresno Bee, and Armida Mendoza, a Fresno-based immigration attorney at law offices of Armida and Mendoza, to talk about how ICE and Border Patrol's tactics have changed in Fresno specifically under the Trump administration. So Melissa, we're going to start with a story that you reported last week, looking at some of the data that has been requested of UC Berkeley deportation data team, looking at what ICE is reporting around who they're detaining, who they're deporting. And you looked at 2024 under the Biden administration and 2025 under the first 7 months of the Trump administration. What is that data telling us about how deportations have changed in the last year?
Yeah, so the deportation data project from the UC Berkeley team requests, they FOIA and they do the federal information requests, and they have monthly data on ICE arrests. That's what we looked at specifically. So the ICE arrests have increased. The first thing that I'll say is they've increased under the Trump administration upwards of 58% compared to the same time period last year, the first 7 months of 2024 compared to 2025.
So it's about, to use actual numbers, about 700 something last year and about 1,100 ballpark this year?
Correct. Okay. There have been an estimated 1,156 arrests in Fresno, Kern, Kings, Madera, Merced, and Tulare counties since January. And then there were 733 arrests in that same region this time last year.
Okay.
What do we know about the locations where people are being detained at this point?
So the largest concentration of arrests look like they took place near Bakersfield. General area is how it's categorized, so we don't know the specific locations, but also in the Fresno area, kind of general area. And Bakersfield has a sub-ICE office, so Fresno falls under the jurisdiction of the San Francisco field office, one of ICE's, I think there's 25 or so field offices nationwide, and Bakersfield is a hub for that. So one data point that the research shows is that their ICE sub-office, there were actually 82 arrests at their office specifically. Fresno is a huge area, about half of all arrests took place in the Fresno general area, and the Fresno office serves multiple counties in the region as well. So it doesn't mean they were all from Fresno, but that those arrests took place here in this region.
As Trump has said multiple times, he says he's only planning on going after people with criminal convictions. How has that played out in the data that you were able to get from the Berkeley team?
That's a great question. So nearly half of the arrests, or 43%, were part of ICE's criminal alien program. I'm super familiar with this program, but what I can say is that it focuses on identifying arrests and a removal of incarcerated individuals at federal, state, and local levels, as well as, I guess, criminals at large. So there were several arrests at our local jails, county jails, state prisons, and federal prisons, which we have several of here in the Valley. Corcoran, Avenal, let me see, FCI Mendota. Those were some of the big names that popped up.
Do we have any information about what the breakdown between people that have committed felonies versus misdemeanors, like the level of crime, or are they just being lumped into one category when we're looking at this?
There's different data sets. So there's another data set that I didn't use for this story, but it focuses on actual removals and people who have already been deported. And that has a little bit more information on types of convictions or crimes, so a criminal history. But what we were able to see in this data was that there was about 65% of those arrested in our region had been convicted of a crime, previously convicted. And that was about 787 of the 1,100. Meanwhile, about 112 people had only had pending criminal charges. That's about 12% of the total. And then the remaining 23%, or 256 individuals, only had some kind of immigration violation.
I see.
So it's interesting because we're, on the other hand, nationwide, most people held in ICE detention have no criminal history, according to the Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse, TRAC, which is a Syracuse University project. The arrests doesn't necessarily match the data of trends of who's in detention nationwide.
Okay. A few weeks ago, several advocates held a press conference in Fresno to protest people being arrested by ICE right outside the courthouses. And just this weekend, the San Francisco Chronicle reported that 25 people were arrested in Stockton during their scheduled appointments. Armida, I want to turn to you. What are you seeing that's different than the way deportations were handled during the Biden and previous administrations.
Yes. In regards to these two scenarios, which is the courthouse's arrest, so what is going on is people are showing up to their first hearing for their criminal case. Some of them maybe were arrested for a DUI. Some of them maybe assault or things like that. And they're going in to try to defend themselves if they believe that there's no evidence against them or that they have a chance of fighting their cases. Since it's the first hearing, they don't have a public defender usually assigned to them. And so when they're arriving to their first hearing, criminal case hearing, which is part of the due process that they have to be able to defend their case, they are being detained either at the restrooms, in hallways, or even coming in to the building. Like, they already have a name and a photo, which is usually their when they were booked in, and then they just detain them. A lot of them don't make it to their hearing, and so that's a problem because then the judges are thinking that they're fleeing, they're not showing up to actually fight their criminal case. The 25 people that were arrested in Stockton this weekend were actually following with their, usually they get a text message or a call from ICE, and they're saying that they're part of the people that have been checking in with ICE regularly, a lot of them for many years now, because they're fighting their cases in courts, in the immigration court, and it's usually backlogged by a lot. And so they've been checking in regularly, and they randomly got a message or a phone call saying you have to show up to Stockton URO this weekend. And so they went as part of their compliance, and then they were detained there without no explanation as to why. And so that, again, both scenarios or both situations are something that was never seen before, especially during Biden administration. During, I know that a lot of people have the conception President Obama deported a lot of people. Yes, he did, but under President Obama and under President Biden, there were such thing as enforcement priorities. So what these, there were categories of people who were considered a priority and people who were not. And so at the beginning, when President Trump came into office, during my Know Your Rights presentations, I would tell people, if you have no criminal record and you're in the household, hopefully you should be fine. And because that was the case previously, even during the first Trump administration, they didn't have the enforcement priority, but they were tending to go or deporting people who had criminal records, or they would consider an enforcement priority.
And can I ask you a question from a legal lens? If someone's not provided an explanation when they're detained, how do you look at that?
The only reason that they're giving now, and that's something that we're seeing with the USCIS office arrests, is that they're saying, oh, you're here without status.
Okay. So that's the explanation they're given. Okay.
That's what they're giving, and that's what they're writing down in their notice to appear, which is the charging document that they present someone when they're in deportation proceedings, and they're saying, you were found to have been here without status.
What does status mean?
No, like, you don't have a permanent residence, you're not a citizen, you are, like, they list a list of things. Like, first, you are a citizen of Mexico or whatever they're from, and then you entered on or about and you were found to not be in lawful status in the United States.
Got it. I think that's an interesting segue into the story, Giselle, that you reported today, which talked to two different people who were detained in the process of obtaining their permanent resident status. And so could you just share a little bit more about the stories that you heard in reporting that story?
Yeah, I'll speak more specifically about one person. His name is Alejandro. He lived in the U.S. since he was 11. He resides in Bakersfield with his wife, Elda, and has 5 U.S.-born children, one who was born last month, and Elda is still recovering from a C-section. And Alejandro specifically has kept his immigration paperwork current, including an approved I-130 petition, which proves a valid family relationship, such as like a marriage or a parent-child relationship that qualifies for immigration benefits, and he has no criminal record. He received a letter in the mail about a week before his October 7th appointment, which just stated that he had to go to a required appointment related to his permanent resident status. And his attorney assured him that nothing would go wrong. And instead, following the appointment, immigration officers detained Alejandro at the USCIS Fresno office, escorted him out through a back entrance, and later transferred him to the Golden State Annex Detention Center. I was able to speak with him over the phone, where he's currently being detained at. And based just on my conversations with him and attorneys and members of the Rapid Response Network teams, this has just become an aggressive trend where most, if not all, people going in for appointments related to their permanent resident status are being detained in the middle of appointments or after, and ICE agents are completely bypassing attorneys. And the same thing happened to Maria Caballero. She was a longtime Fireball resident with no criminal record who was detained a day after Alejandro at the USCIS appointment in Fresno to adjust status.
Armida, this brings a lot of questions, at least to me, about just a lot of people in the Trump administration or allies of the Trump administration, they're saying we're going after criminals, we're going after people who aren't following the right process. But maybe you could just help illuminate.
They're obstructing the process, right? They're creating a situation where they're creating more of what they want for their narrative in some ways.
Totally. I think that most normal people don't understand the immigration process and how convoluted it is. And I realize that's a big thing to throw at you, but could you just explain to our listeners what that looks like to follow the process and to follow the rules?
Yes, so there's such part of the regulations and part of the Immigration Nationality Act allow for some U.S. citizen, let's say, petitioning their spouse that maybe entered with the visa at some point. The regulations allow for that person or the beneficiary, that's what they're called, beneficiary, to be able to have the fact that they were in the United States without status be forgiven because their spouse or their petitioner is a U.S. citizen. And the process would be, let's file an I-130, it's which family petition establishes a relationship. We prove that the marriage is legitimate through bona fide evidence, which is a term that they use. And we indicate that it was made for legitimate reasons, such as love, not for any other reason, correct? And then we submit they have children, birth certificates of their children, evidence that they have joint properties, joint bank accounts, things like that. And then the second step, and sometimes for people that enter with the visa, we can do it concurrently with the I-130, we file the application for adjustment of status, which is where they apply for their permanent residence. The INA and the regulations have a list of things that disqualify individuals from being able to obtain their status. So usually, in most cases, they cannot have any criminal history. Certain immigration violations will disqualify them as well, such as being detained at the border or things like that.
What's the typical time span of how long this process takes?
Usually, if we do a one step, which is what we call the I-130 and the 485 application, usually takes around 6 to 8 months. Although I filed a case in August and we got scheduled for the interview last week. So it was ridiculous. It was like a month and a half. Thankfully, in my case, everything went well for my client, but we are starting to see more quicker turnarounds in certain field offices. Not Fresno. Fresno, we've seen 6 to 8 months. It's the normal standard.
And that's to become a legal permanent resident.
Yes, that's correct.
With a green card?
Yes, with the green card.
With and potentially a path to citizenship at some point?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. And yes. Once they get a green card, how long does it take to become a U.S. citizen generally?
So it depends. If they're married to a U.S. citizen, then they can apply for citizenship after 3 years. And if they are, then if not, then they would have to wait the 5 years.
Got
to
it.
Become a U.S. citizen.
And then they also have to pass the test.
Exactly.
With an immigration officer, spelling and reading.
Yeah. Yes.
And meet the good moral character, because that's something that's required for citizenship. So something I feel like it's a lot of people don't understand, that there's a lot of screenings through the process. And so these people who are applying for the permanent residence, they went through that screening, either immigration and criminal, and they met the requirements in most cases, and they're still being detained. And the only reason they're giving is that we were here without status.
Like, so they're being treated the same as the other folks, the other
yes.
category. Okay.
Yes.
And that's just one of several ways to yes. obtain residency, yes. status, citizenship.
What's your hypothesis on why the Trump administration is now going after people who are in the middle of the process to become permanent and legal residents of the U.S. and eventually citizens?
I think it's because they're easy targets. I think that they're coming to them because they want to follow the steps. When we say follow the rules, we mean follow the steps and rules required, and they meet the eligibility requirements, and the INA and the regulations allow for them to do this. And then they're coming to them voluntarily because they think, okay, like this is the last step for my permanent residence, and then they're just detaining them there. So I think they're just easy targets. They're doing that for people who are appearing for their interviews, for their residency, and they're doing that for people who are going into their ICE check-ins when prompted.
Okay. This is a question for both Melissa and Giselle. Given all the chaos of this and the uncertainty of what to expect when you're going to an immigration office, what are both of you hearing from experts and how people should think about their own particular situations and how to approach it when you're uncertain of what could come by stepping into a government building?
Based on what, like, my conversations with attorneys, some attorneys are recommending, like, just rescheduling appointments or asking to attend these appointments that are required by immigration agents virtually to minimize risk, while others advise clients to keep their appointments, but to make sure to have a family preparedness plan in case they're detained. And a family preparedness plan, so really fleshed out, just document that really describes what, like, personal information, contact information for family in case that person's detained, that person, an attorney can be able to contact that family and be able to help and keep everyone in the loop. And it also shows just if the person detained who has children, yeah, who can have temporary guardianship during that time. And so someone that I spoke to, her name is Nora for the story. She's Faith in the Valley's Watch Network program manager. She said that it's just critical for people to continue to attend all scheduled appointments, whether it's a USCIS meeting or an ICE check-in or a court hearing, because missing one can have severe consequences. An immigration court, like failing to appear, allows a judge to issue a deportation order in absentia in county court. It can lead to like a bench warrant. And so she's urging people to go, but to make sure that if people can reach out to Faith in the Valley's Watch Network so that there can be like a legal observer that can be present during appointments in case like someone is wrongfully detained, that there is a witness proof that they can actually document what's happening. And then I also spoke to other attorneys who've just said that make sure to seek legal help before even attending immigration interviews in the first place or filing applications on their own. And people have a right to see a judge and fight their case, even if detained, especially if someone doesn't have a criminal record and meets the requirements and are following the law for permanent residence specifically.
Melissa, what would you add to that?
Yeah, I think that's also what I'm hearing from immigration experts and lawyers. I did speak with Tillman Jacobs, who's an immigrants' rights supervising attorney with the Asian Law Caucus, for a story that we reported on Southeast Asians and Hmong individuals who are being detained at their ICE check-ins. And he also just advised faith leaders can join you in attending some of these ICE check-ins. So that's also an opportunity and an option.
Armita, how are you advising your clients on how to approach their immigration check-ins at this point?
We are going. I've given them the option of also rescheduling. And my client that had his interview last week, he said, I'm filled with anxiety. I cannot sleep. It's been weeks since I could sleep in peace. So I just want to go ahead with it. I can't endure this much longer. And if I'm going to get detained, then it's something that we're already planning, getting some evidence that we would file in case he was given the opportunity to do a bond hearing. And I explain and walk him through what would happen. Okay, if you're detained, this is what's going to happen. And these are the next steps. And this is going to be our strategy. And this is going to be our plan. And this is what we're going to need to prove at a bond hearing. So start gathering the evidence, have it ready in a folder. Hopefully we won't need it, but just be ready. And then in my client's case, they didn't have any children. But for people that do have children, I also tell them it's very important to do the family preparedness plan and to have a plan ready. And if for those that don't qualify for bond, then we are also instructing them to have a habeas attorney ready to be able to represent them in a habeas petition.
Is there any penalty or negative effects from rescheduling repeatedly? Could that initiate something?
Yes, they're being denied. So I did a consultation for someone who was referred through a series of nonprofit organizations that she had been instructed to just keep rescheduling it because she was having some other issues. And she rescheduled 3 times and then received a denial notice. And then suddenly received another interview notice after she had been denied since May, instructing her to go in to the USCIS office this month.
And that's strange.
Yes.
And bureaucracy, yes.
And we knew exactly why she was being scheduled for that interview and what was going to happen at that interview. And another attorney stepped in and was able to assist her to try to apply for another benefit, such as protection against violence.
Armita, I guess to both Giselle and Melissa as well, a question that I have is, you look at the news around what's happening around immigration in the U.S. over the last 9 months now, and you see the National Guard deployed in different cities, massive workplace raids happening, especially in Los Angeles, to a lesser extent in the Bay Area. Should we think of the scale of enforcement as less in the Central Valley because we're not seeing workplace raids, or how do you think about that overall?
Yeah. I think I'm part of the rapid response attorneys team here in Fresno, and we do get calls. I would say we're not getting bombarded with calls every day, although I'm not a dispatcher, so I'm not 100% sure what type of calls we get. But as an attorney responder that I'm assigned Mondays, I would say I've been called maybe 10 times to go and respond throughout the year. So I think that's a fairly low number. And so That's the information that I have. As to why, I am not quite sure. We're seeing a shift in strategy. We're seeing the USCIS arrests, which were very alarming, specifically for me, because it's, okay, so then what do we tell our community? Apply? No, don't apply. Yes, apply. But if you're going to apply, then you're going to be put in detention center, and if you don't fall under people who could get bond, you're just going to be stuck there for months and years. It's really hard situation to be in, and so it's been very difficult in terms of that specific area. But I would say in terms of how many arrests we're seeing, I would say that on specifically the days that I cover and what my colleagues are reporting, it's that we're not getting bombarded, but we are planning already for a mass raid, such as what happened in Camarillo, if you know what happened in LA. So we have been strategizing against, okay, what would we do? What are the next steps? Okay, if mass raids happens, what are all the attorneys on call throughout the week? What are we expected to do? So we are preparing for it because we know it's a matter of time.
Yeah. I'll add that the arrest data shows there has been clearly an increase in arrests. We don't have these big, large-scale public operations that we're seeing in other big, large cities, except that we did have two Border Patrol operations. There was the Kern County return to sender in January, and then they came back to Sacramento in July for a day or two.
And do you think that's just population density? Like bigger cities have more dense, more people, more opportunity?
I think there's a lot of speculation on, is it the big cities that are the targets? Is it
the Democratic mayors?
Yes. Yeah, is it that? Is it the, of course, we have the agricultural industry here, and are they lobbying to protect their workforce with the Trump administration and advocating behind the scenes? Sacramento Bee did some reporting on analyzing arrests in California and why speculation and just questioning people on why is this region being largely avoided by the administration. But there's also a lawsuit. So after the January return to sender operation, the ACLU and the United Farm Workers sued the Border Patrol over in the Eastern, in a federal court, right? So that's a court that in that case is being played out as we speak. And there is a preliminary injunction that would put more reporting requirements and scrutiny on any Border Patrol operations here in the region. So that could be providing some relief just as that case is making its way through the appeal as well. So I don't know if we just, one expert I spoke with for my last story, it was Bill Hing, who said because of the Supreme Court's ruling recently, which he said basically allows for racial profiling, we should expect to see more enforcement here in the region.
Giselle, I found an interesting component of your story was the section about notaries giving people bad advice. I want to hear your perspective, also our media as well, your perspective from the legal profession. Can you explain this phenomenon? What's going on? Is it false advertising, or why are people trusting notaries to give them legal advice?
Yeah, I can definitely explain that. It's really well known in Fresno that many notaries downtown and just others across the city advertise that they're offering notary service, but also at the same time, tax preparation and immigration assistance. And this is a practice that's also common throughout California. But according to state law, notaries are prohibited from performing legal document preparation or immigration services. A California notary cannot advertise as both an immigration consultant and a notary individual. And notaries prey on community members' vulnerability here. They're offering false legal services, promising to file petitions or screen eligibility, even though they have no legal authority to do. And my source, Nora, said that these businesses often here in Fresno exploit community trusts, especially during tax season when clients who rely on them for tax help are also turning to them for immigration support.
Donnie, do you think there's anything the city could do about that? Is this like city's attorney's office kind of question?
Potentially. I kind of want to look at Armida and see if she has a better answer to that as a legal professional. So notaries or notarios in Latin American countries are also attorneys. So we think that is reason number one why a lot of our community turns to notarios or notaries is because they think that they're also attorneys, but they're not. And this battle with notaries and like the information that they give out or has been happening for as long as I've been in the field, which is 12 years or longer. And I just think that the community tends to trust, we trust people. And so they say, oh, this person helped my relative.
they can help me too. And what they don't understand is that every case is very different. And so I've also seen, I've done consultations in my various positions in nonprofits and pro bono consults of people who, because they went to a notary, they didn't receive the appropriate advice. Now they are in a worse situation than they were had they gone to someone who would have probably given them like a background check or done more through work on their applications, or in some cases they fill out the forms incorrectly as well because they change so rapidly and they don't receive training, so they're just guessing and winging it as they go. And so that's something, it's been a long-standing battle. Now more than ever, at least when I do presentations, I always tell the community, now more than ever, please don't go to notaries, please don't fill out your own applications. Like, things are changing so rapidly and you need to go to, there's no, if you can't afford an attorney, it's okay, go to a nonprofit. There's so many nonprofits that offer free legal representation and assistance. They're trained, they're accredited, they can do this work. Please try to find help elsewhere. Don't go to notarios, don't fill out your own applications. And so it's something that, it's a message that it's part of our routine, and we always mention, even when I do a consultation and I tell the person, you don't qualify and this is why, then my last message is, please don't go to a notary and expect them to be a miracle fixer and be able to do this, because I'm explaining to you, and if you have any questions, please come back to me and ask me, and I won't charge you, I promise. But I just want to know, I want you to have your questions answered and explained as to why you don't qualify, and you know, and don't go to someone who promises you the moon and the stars, because that's what they do. And then not only notaries, but also we're seeing a lot of fraud. I go and do pro bono consults at the Mexican consulate, and I've seen there maybe 10 people come in already with a lot of fraud through WhatsApp, that they even pretend to be officers and do the interviews through the phone, and yikes, they're charging people thousands of dollars. Oh. And so we're seeing that a lot. And
that's wild.
Are these, yes, notaries, because there's most of the forms have, did someone fill this out for you? Are they labeling that at the bottom, or are they just turning it in as their own?
Some put themselves as preparers. Okay. They cannot file H-28, but most, I would say, they don't fill out anything. They fill it out as if the person's filing it themselves.
I see. Okay, so yeah. Fraud, yeah.
I just want to add one more thing on enforcement here in the region. SF Chronicle did a story about ICE deportations statewide in California up 78% under Trump, and they did a similar analysis of the Deportation Data Project information. And what they found is roughly 5,500 people have been deported in the first 7 months of the year, whereas our analysis found of these arrests in the Valley, 1,100 arrests, 500 people have already been deported. So that's about 10% of the total, and that's roughly our population of the state from the regions that I looked at. I think even though we're not seeing agents on our streets in the same way as some of these big cities,
It's happening.
Yeah. It's happening.
We're increased. More distributed, so we maybe
and
don't see it.
And it's a lot of the procedural going after people who are doing their check-ins and following the rules. It's less of the showing up at Home Depot, that sort of action. So what are we going forward, and Armita, how do you think, I know you're in the trenches every single day working with your clients to prepare, but how do you think about how, just as a region, our leaders and our community should think about preparing for an uncertain immigration future? You just saw last week that ICE is starting to give tickets to people who do not carry their papers on them, which is, I did not know that was technically part of the law. So should we expect more of that? Should we expect more about racial profiling? How do you think we should prepare?
Yes, so the message that in the different collaboratives that I'm part of, the rapid responses, the message we want to give the community is power, not panic. So it's like, how do we empower ourselves with information, with preparation, with knowing, having a plan, having a list of contacts that attorneys or in the value, in the rapid response number memorized, things like that, as a community, reminding our community that we're not alone. As attorneys, we're not alone. As community members, we're not alone. As every aspect of our society, we're not alone, and that we are forming community and trying to support each other in every different capacity that we can. Yeah. So that's honestly, that's been my message, because I don't know. I cannot promise them what's going to happen. We hope that we learn a lot of lessons from this administration. And once this is over, that as community, we learn a lot of the stuff that was going on in detention centers during Biden administration. A lot of people didn't know about it. A lot of people didn't even know we had detention centers in the Central Valley. And only the few people that were affected by that knew what was actually happening and knew what was going on. Myself included, when I started working in detention centers, is when I realized, oh my gosh, this is happening. These people are representing themselves in immigration court court proceedings? Like, how is this happening? When I started working at the organization that would do pro bono assistance in the detention centers, when I learned all this, and I didn't know that before. And I had been in the field for 12 years, working solely on affirmative cases, family-based cases. So now all this, we are becoming aware. And I think that there's no turning back, and now we have to do something about this. We have to ICE their techniques. They have done this for many years, the lying, the deceiving, the intimidating, but only a few people knew. And so now we're all aware of what they're doing and their tactics. And so that's something also that I'm telling people in my presentations or in my pro bono consults, is remember that these people are, their job is to deport you. Do not believe anything they tell you, because they will tell them, like from the people that were detained at the USCIS interviews, two of my clients that were detained, when I would go to the ICRO office, ICE had already talked to them, and they had already told them, you have no option, sign, and I was waiting outside. That's a clear violation of constitutional rights. You cannot talk to my client without their attorney present. Their attorney's waiting, and I was already waiting to talk to them, and they would go and intimidate them inside. And so by the time I talked to them, I would try to, like, you do tell one of the officers, I told you not to talk to my client. Like, I was literally waiting outside, and they disregard, and they don't care. So I think now that we're bringing attention to this, there's no turning back. We got to do something with this information that we're finding out, and we have to protect our communities and ourselves.
Melissa, I want to ask you like a 20,000 foot question. What are the second order effects of this chaos? People not showing up for medical appointments, people not filing their government paperwork on time. I think we're talking about the immediate effects for the individuals, but what's the second order effects for people more broadly in the region, for Fresno? How would you think about it, that question?
That's a really good question. What's on my mind a lot is just the history of raids in the Central Valley. This is not a new practice. And I spoke earlier this year with Juan Uranga, who's a retired former leader of California Rural Legal Assistance, who said, look, it's not just the deportation. It's the fear. It's the ripple effect on communities, on families, on people not showing up, like you said, for medical appointments, changing their lives around for school, not going out of the house to go grocery shopping. I even actually interviewed a citizen who's carrying her passport on her because of fears of being profiled and arrested, and she's not leaving her home unless it's necessary, grocery shopping, an actual U.S. citizen. So I think there's a lot to unpack, and we'd love to just do that next step of just understanding what is the ripple effect of all of this enforcement on humans, on families, on communities.
We always conclude these podcasts with what we're loving this week. I'm going to start this week because there was a mystery. I don't know if it was solved or just fixed. In my neighborhood, there is a pumpkin man. He's like a pumpkin head, full body.
Do you know the pumpkin man?
Okay, so he's on, I forget the name of the street.
It's on Wilson.
Yeah, he's like two blocks from my house. And the pumpkin man went missing. Someone kidnapped the pumpkin man from the neighborhood. It's very frustrating. I jog down that street, and I would wave to the pumpkin man every time I ran past him. And then one day, the pumpkin man wasn't there. And some civically inclined community members created wanted posters for the missing pumpkin man. And the pumpkin man is back. I think the actual original pumpkin man was not found, but the homeowner created a second pumpkin man just to fix the situation. And it can be really hard when you, like, put that effort out in the community and then it gets treated that way. But I think often the answer is to just keep going and not give up, even when someone steals one of your pumpkins. But he's wearing a chef's hat right now, a chef tote. So if you're driving down Wilson in the Fresno High area, you will see a fantastic pumpkin man sporting a tote, and it's good news. We have pumpkin man back. Donnie, what are you loving this week?
Maybe I'll take that note about chef's hats and talk about a YouTuber that I've been influenced by from my son, who
Nick.
Is a chef, Nick DiGiovanni.
Yes, I have watched clips with Donnie's son, this guy.
And I'm not a big YouTube person, but my kid is. And Nick DiGiovanni is a chef who has a YouTube channel. It's actually quite entertaining. I learned how to cook a steak from this guy you got to have a crust on your steak. I just learned this. Mm. My parents did not teach me how to cook growing up, so I've had to learn on my own. But he's just a lot of fun. So
yeah, he's very entertaining, and he does like strange, kind of funny, gimmicky stuff.
And he's obsessed, like in a stalker-like way, with Gordon Ramsay, which is endearing.
Yeah, that's very sweet. Melissa, what about you? What are you loving this week?
I'm loving Frankenstein. Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein. Yeah, I just saw it last night at the Maya Theater and highly recommend it.
Was it a packed house?
There were a total of three of us there at 9:30 showing last night, unfortunately. It was kind of late. It was on a school night, so I get it. But
Is it definitely scary?
Yeah, it's no.
Or is it like mood, or is it like jump scares? I like to know before I step into a theater what to expect.
From what I'm hearing from my film friends is that this one was pretty accurate to the book.
Okay.
So
the Mary Shelley
original.
That's cool.
Yeah. So I think that was an intentional.
I loved
move
the book.
There. I loved the book too. And
how did he do with the monster, with the makeup and everything else? The monster.
I thought it looked
terrifying.
Great. You just have to see it. I don't want to spoil anything, but I love Guillermo del Toro. Yes, that's what's giving me joy this week.
Fantastic. Armina, what about you? What are you loving this week?
That my client got an approval in Chatsworth, so we have a new permanent resident.
Nice.
He should be expecting his green card within the next 4 weeks. So that was one of my birthday wishes, and I got it. So it was a good birthday. And then my son, I recently enrolled him in karate because he wanted to do some sort of add another thing to our evening schedules. And so he's really enjoying it. So seeing him super excited about his karate classes,
that's awesome.
Definitely
that's
been a highlight.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Giselle, what are you loving this week?
Everything and anything spooky season. I'm a very big Halloween fan. I just was with my partner at this little Halloween event at Forestieri's Underground Garden, if those who've not been there, they're guided tours of the Underground Garden created by one man and one man only. And so for this Halloween event specifically, it's not like a guided tour. Like you get to walk on your own throughout the paths and
is it get spooky in there?
It's spooky in there. It's like half.
There's not people like jumping out at you.
Oh, it's family friendly. It would be insane.
Like some Fresno Fright Night versions of the Underground Garden.
It's family friendly, kid friendly, unlimited candy if you want to continuously go through the paths. If you love candy, that is what me and my partner did. But no, it's half spooky in the sense of some of the tunnels, like there's red lights and purple lights and you can't really see at the end of the tunnel until you turn, and that's the spooky part. But mostly it's very nice, like Halloween decorations like spread everywhere. And yeah, it was just a really good time just seeing the kids in their costumes and running around and trying to get all the candy, and then there was like games and stuff for them and like live music. And yeah, it was a really good time.
This is the last podcast before Halloween. Do we all have costumes? I'm gonna be a character from the Sonic universe, Dr. Eggman. I've got a bald cap and goggles and strange things. When you work at a public school, you gotta really step it up. Do you guys have costumes?
Not yet, but I need to plan
plots
something.
Or plans.
I'm pretty sure my niece, I'm going trick-or-treating with my nieces and nephews, and I'm pretty sure my niece is doing some K-pop Demon Hunter situation.
Yes.
And
I mean, my daughter's going to be Rumi from K-pop Demon Hunters.
Yep. That's the one.
And I was at a wedding this weekend, and we were talking about all the adult K-pop Demon Hunter costumes and how someone was going to be Baby Saja, another person was going to be Jinu. And so then I was like, maybe I should be Gui Ma, who's like the master demon.
There you go.
So if I can pull it together, I have a really busy week, so I don't know if I can pull a costume together to be a master demon, but
You could do it.
I'll do my best.
A friend of mine's daughter is dressing up as a Labubu, which I don't understand what even that means. Can anyone shed some light on this for me, what exactly that is?
You need to talk to Eliana about this.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I'll get her advice and perspective. This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom.
And this podcast was recorded at Sun Stereo Warehouse in downtown Fresno. Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinan, and our song comes from Stateless Rat.